I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio.
I'm Carrie Donahue, and this is Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio.
Carrie, what are you doing?
Alec, don't you remember? The staff of the show is going to be hosting episodes from the archives every other week for the rest of the summer.
I completely forgot that.
Well, it's happening.
Oh, okay. Well, best of luck, Carrie.
Thanks, Alec. It happens pretty often on this show, but I'm a sucker for when Alec talks with other actors. Two of my favorite interviews he's done were with Julianne Moore and Maggie Gyllenhaal. They are both so talented and often take on surprising, challenging projects. Alec talked with Maggie Gyllenhaal in 2018, just after the release of The Kindergarten Teacher. We'll get into that conversation shortly. Alec's conversation with Julianne Moore took place in 2014. Julianne Moore has been nominated for 5 Academy Awards: Boogie Nights, The End of the Affair, Far From Heaven, The Hours, and she won Best Actress for her work in Still Alice. She played a linguistics professor diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease soon after her 50th birthday. Alec Baldwin played her husband. They worked together again on 30 Rock. Julianne Moore was very funny as Jack Donaghy's high school crush, Nancy Donovan. They share something else in common, too. Alec and Julianne Moore both started on daytime soaps, which came up when they talked about going to drama school.
I was, for some reason, thinking about a friend of mine who didn't go to drama school in the car on the way here, and I wonder what it was like for her because she, you know, hasn't seemed to need it. And there are a lot of things that I did in drama school that I think I didn't need either. But then in retrospect, I'm like, you know, it's helpful. Did you go to drama school?
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you go?
NYU.
Oh, okay. Did you go straight on to Search for Tomorrow then?
The doctors. Can't believe you just said that. I can't believe.
Why?
Because I have in front of me. I wasn't going to go there right off.
Oh, but
now that
you've
opened that window, you were Fanny and Sabrina Hughes.
That's right. Franny, not Fanny. Franny and Sabrina.
Someone else was Fanny Hughes. You were Franny
I
Hughes.
I was Franny Hughes.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. I mean, couldn't it have been Francie?
Yeah.
Or Francis?
Laura Dern was Fanny Hughes.
She was.
you were Franny and Sabrina Hughes mm-hmm. on World Turns. Mm-hmm. And before that, you did Edge.
I did Edge. Were you on Edge?
See, if you're on soaps, only when you're on a soap can you say Edge.
Edge.
Search.
Yeah. World
yeah.
Turns.
Yeah. Days.
Days. That's so funny because I was on Edge when they were on East 49th Street in that really, really tiny studio. Remember? Now Rachel Ray shoots there.
Yeah.
And really tiny.
Soaps are gone.
I know. They're gone.
Soaps are gone. There's just a couple left. There's 4 soaps left.
And I work with people. The guy that played my dad, Don Hastings, he started that show 2 months before I was born. So he had been on that show my entire lifetime when I got on. And when the show was gone, he was still on it, too. He was the most wonderful guy, so funny.
But do you feel in some ways, I don't want to exaggerate, but
yeah.
wasn't doing a soap like some of the most honest work you've ever done in your
Absolutely,
life?
Absolutely, because you have nothing to help
there's
you.
There's no frills.
There's no dialogue.
Frills.
I mean, the dialogue is so rough, so basic. All you're doing is establishing story. I used to do what they called emotional apple. Okay, where if I had to say something that was really just plot-oriented, I'd try to, like, cry on top of it or laugh on top of it or anything just to make it mean something.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah, because it's all exposition.
Well, I read somewhere where you said that doing the soap gave you experience mm-hmm. and confidence.
Absolutely.
Or discipline. It was discipline and confidence.
Well, because
I loved that.
Yeah, because no one has time to help you. You know, the directors are working really fast. The writers are working fast. The other actors are working really quickly. You're just on your own. I remember Marissa Tomei, she played my best friend, Marcy. She said, we got into the elevator, and she looked at me, and she goes, remember, L is for lunch, because that was where the lobby was, and so in that cafeteria, and that was like the best piece of advice because I was like on my own.
For lunch.
Remember, L is for lunch. And then we did a scene together, and it went by so quickly. You know, we did one and a half takes or something, and she goes, you feel terrible, don't you? I said, uh-huh. She goes, it happens all the time. You'll get used to it.
Yeah. You're going to walk out here feeling crappy 2 out of 5 days of the week.
That's right.
I just remember when I did that show, you had to show up on time.
Yeah.
They didn't know your dialogue.
Yeah.
And no matter how excruciating it was, if you didn't, they fired you.
You had to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning. You'd rehearse. You were on camera. I would have sometimes 30 pages of dialogue a day for 3 years. So it was like a boom, 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 boom. And then you finish maybe 7:30, 8, 9 if you go late. You know, it was crazy.
How long did you do the soap for? World Turns was your contract.
It was my contract. It was a 3-year contract.
You did it for 3 years.
CBS, they would do 3 years. The ABC ones would do 2 years and stuff, but they never gave me an option, although they had the option to fire me at any time.
Right. It's their option.
Yeah, it was their option.
And when you finished, what did you do?
I went to the Guthrie Theater, actually, and I did Hamlet.
With?
Hamlet. Zeljko Ivanek.
I saw you.
You did not.
I saw you.
No, come on.
Do you want to know something?
Yeah.
I can tell you right now. I did Loot with him on Broadway in 1986.
Zeljko.
You did it with Zeljko.
Yeah.
You did the show the following year in 87
or
88?
It was 87 or 87. Yeah, something like that.
I flew to Minneapolis to see Zeljko.
Holy cow.
I saw you do Hamlet at the Guthrie.
Well, I wasn't a Hamlet. I was Ophelia.
Yeah, you were
exactly. Hamlet.
I saw you.
What did you think?
I thought it was fantastic.
You don't remember me, do you?
Do you want to know something? I do. And Zeljko Ivanek, you were very young. You were a child.
Yes.
And Zeljko Ivanek, he was probably one of the best Hamlets I've ever seen.
Because
he didn't have to push.
No.
He seems like a very dark, kind of conflicted person.
And he
also
seemed like a very young man, you know? I think that was interesting about both Zeljko and I were very small, very slender and tiny. And we looked like teenagers, kind of, you know. So
who directed?
Garland Wright, who I adored. He passed away. But boy, I loved Garland. He was great. It was a really interesting production.
I love Zeljko.
Zeljko was
great.
There's
a thing that people strain for when they play Hamlet that he has innately that I really, really loved.
Mm-hmm.
So you did the Guthrie and then...
And I went to the Actors Theater of Louisville and did some plays there, an Arthur Coppett play, and then...
So there wasn't an idea that you want to kind of strap yourself into the rocket sled here and get going, L.A., TV, movies, no?
No, I mean, I also worked at the Public, I did some plays, and then I met Andre Gregory and I did Vanya. And all along, though, I was auditioning for stuff and I got TV movies and things, but it wasn't until I was 29... that I got my first movie, which was an HBO movie called Cast a Deadly Spell. And then I did Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Mm-hmm. And then I did Shortcuts. And then I did Safe. And then my movie career didn't really start happening until I was 29, 30. So for it was just theater.
Would you say
television.
Shortcuts was the biggest break you had at that time?
Well, what happened was I did Shortcuts, Vanya and 42nd Street, and Safe. So it was kind of the beginning of the independent theater movement, if you will, and they all came out within the same year. And I went from being an actress who had no profile at all in film, none, because I couldn't get arrested doing movies. I mean, I would never get cast. To
Do
suddenly,
you know why?
I don't know. You know, honestly, I didn't get them. And in the 80s, I can remember, for a ton of things. I remember auditioning for lots of Merchant Ivory movies. I always wanted to get one of those because those were such a big deal. I would audition for big comedies. I just didn't get them. And I was like, you know.
I remember the same thing. You'd be sitting there going, man, I want to get me one of them John Sayles movies.
That's why. I
need to be in one of those movies.
I auditioned for him constantly. Yeah. I never got them. I actually got really close to a few things, but I never got anything. Where I did really well was in television. I kept booking TV things. But, you know, they would put you on hold, and then you'd do pilots for them. And that's the other thing, too. My pilots—
Holding deals.
They wouldn't get picked up. Whenever anybody says, how do you plan your career, you know, I mean, you laugh, because we don't have any control. There's
but the
no
funny thing about
anything.
It is, you seem like somebody who's had a plan.
No, uh-uh.
Once you started making films, were there things you just didn't do anymore? Did you try to say, I'm going to put all my eggs in this basket?
No, most of the time you just do with what you're offered, you know.
The best of what you're offered.
You do the best of what you're offered. You know, I think after I was on the soap, I did, you know, I didn't spend a lot of money. I kept my money in the bank. So then I spent some time doing theater because I really felt like I wanted to do that. You know,
you took
good
care of yourself.
Yeah, I wanted to do that kind of stuff. And then I would do some TV movies and try to get, you know, and then the holding deals too, that you make money doing that.
But in between Shortcuts and playing Sarah Palin, there's not a lot of TV in between there. Once you start making movies big time, you're making movies.
Yes, that's true.
You don't go back to TV very much at all.
No. Because also it's kind of, it changed, you know, because there was a period too where, because now it's sort of, they call it, you know, now it's the golden age of television. Now there is such kind of interesting quality stuff on television, you know, great writing, great acting, and, you know. So I think things did change. But there was a period when TV was very basic network stuff was not terribly interesting.
What was it like when you met Altman?
Oh, man. He came to see Vanya, you know, when we were doing Uncle Vanya, and he sat there, and I couldn't believe he was there. I don't even know if I said anything to him that day because he's the reason that I feel like I'm a film actor. Because when I went to school in Boston, there were all those revival houses. Do you remember revival houses?
Sure.
This is like, hey, Grandpa, sure. Grandma says, yes. You remember that?
I remember Cinema Village is around 13th
exactly.
Street.
Take your walk.
Where would you go?
I went to the Brattle Theater in Harvard Square. So the Brattle was a revival house and used to have all these different weird double bills and stuff. And I saw Three Women, Altman's Three Women. And somehow I made it through the 70s without seeing Nashville or Brewster McCloud or McCabe and Mrs. Miller or any of those movies. So I'm watching MASH and I was like, who made this movie? This movie's incredible. And it was the first time as a young person that I noticed a directorial hand, you know, where I was like, this is a specific kind of storytelling and it's eliciting a specific kind of acting. I kind of walked out of there and I thought, I want to do that. And of course, it wasn't in the realm of possibility for me the first 10 years of my career.
He came and saw Vanya.
So he saw Vanya, and then he met me on The Player, which I desperately wanted. I remember sitting there talking to him. He said, I'm not going to give this to you. I was like, okay. And that was it, and I was devastated. And then I got this phone call out of the blue for Shortcuts. Hi, it's Bob Altman. Do you remember me? Know who I am? And I thought it was somebody playing a trick on me. I really did. I didn't think it was possible that he, you know, that's when we had hard lines too, you know,
right.
Pick up your phone. And he said, I have this movie that I want you to do. And I said, I'll do it. And he goes, no, I want you to read it first. And then you can tell me if you want to do it, you know. But it was really, really, really a dream come true to work with him. What an amazing man.
It's no secret, I think, when you're in the business, or we're out of it, but especially when you're in the business, that casting and effective casting is 60% or more of a director's job.
Right.
They want to just bring people to the party who know how to hit the ball. And he was someone who, I'll never forget, someone said to me, they were all gathered there in this ersatz rehearsal. Some of them were able to attend and some weren't. And Bob just turned to everybody and said, Anouka May was in it,
uh-huh.
And Mastroianni and Sophia Loren.
And he
looked at them and he was like, now Anouk, you just go ahead and speak French. You speak French if
uh-huh.
you want to, or English or Italian. Marcello, say whatever you want to say. Y'all just say anything you want to say and speak in whatever language you want to speak
right.
in. And I'll fix it in the edit.
Yeah.
I'm going to subtitle it or whatever. He seems so uncontrolling.
He was. The thing about Bob was that you couldn't do anything wrong. So it made you feel like you could do anything. And you would do anything for him. You'd be like, oh, what can I do? What can I do? And he's like, whatever you want to do. But it wasn't like it was chaos. You know, he set up, it was like there was a corral that all the actors were in. And it was his corral. And even with an improv, he'd say, okay, you know, improv this. He'd say, now let's do it again. But this time you just say that part. So he was in complete control of it, but he really made you feel so free and so loved.
Non-judgmental.
Yeah.
There's a quote I read about you where someone says, they cast you in Shortcuts and you were a total unknown.
That's right.
She's a total unknown, they said, casting in this role of Shortcuts. And I thought, and by then you've been working for almost 10 years
in the
business.
10 years. However, within that cast, I was the only person, and there were, 30 people in it, who wasn't famous. So
isn't it amazing how in the movie business
that you're a
you
total
are an
unknown.
Unknown if you haven't done a movie?
I know.
That any of us have seen.
Exactly.
What changed after you did that film? Did you change?
Personally, did I change?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anything
I'm ugly
changed.
And I have no talent.
That's right. And now I'm beautiful.
Did you start to get curious?
And then I got, and then I became talented
I'm
and
gorgeous. And I know everything.
Well, you know what was interesting? And I think this is, and it's actually very similar to what I felt growing up as a kid. You would be in one situation, you'd be at a school and maybe you would be a kid who wasn't very popular and no one thought you were, you know, very interesting or something. And then you'd move to another school. At that school, everybody would think you were interesting for some reason. It would just happen. And you'd think like, well, I was the same person. I haven't changed that much. So it's
the perception
just how
people,
the perception has changed.
And now the perception of you has changed after Altman.
So that's what happened to me too. So after 10 years of doing television and theater, although people don't see the theater, so they don't think you really exist, they see TV, people thought, oh, she's a TV actress. And then I do work with Andre Gregory and Louis Malle, and I work with, you know, Robert Altman, and I work with Todd Haynes, and suddenly I'm a huge film discovery. I'm in this amazing,
everyone
you know,
wants you.
Yeah. And then I'm like, I'm the same person, the same
right.
thing. So I think oddly what happens is that you don't change a perception of yourself. You're like, well, clearly it's just, yeah, other people's perception. It solidified my own work ethic. It doesn't matter where I'm working.
Did you feel that the way you grew up fed this in terms of you being, because you had to reinvent yourself.
Yeah, well, and also
you were seen by a fresh set of eyes again and again and again.
You have to discover a core self and a core sense of values. And people kind of poo poo and say like, oh, TV or oh, this or that. And I'm like, you know, nuh-uh.
Yeah.
It's all valuable, all of it. You know, yeah.
Even when I do radio announcing,
it's important.
I do.
Like, work is work.
I owe them my best.
And it's also it's valuable for you to do your best, no matter where you are, too. I really, really believe that. You know, in everything you do. And I also resent it when people say that they can't do something, like they were terrible waitress. And I'm like, why? Because you weren't paying attention?
You're supposed to write down what I
said. Yeah. So it's important, no matter what you're doing, to put effort into it, I think.
Julianne Moore. Did you know that there are 250 episodes in the Here's the Thing archive? If you like these kinds of in-depth conversations between Alec and other actors, policymakers, and musicians, go to heresthething.org and take a look around. After the break, we'll hear more of Alec's conversation with Julianne Moore. I'm Carrie Donahue, still in for Alec Baldwin on Here's the Thing, revisiting his 2014 conversation with actor Julianne Moore. Alec was surprised to learn that Julianne Moore's career didn't really take off until she did a string of independent films in the 90s.
In the 90s in particular, when there were a lot of people who were working who were writer-directors, and they were kind of, it was sort of a really great, great period for independent film, I think people were looking to tell these really unusual stories. And there wasn't an economic expectation on them either. That's changed. So it was about being involved in that narrative and in that vision and stuff. You know, it really was bringing that story to life, I think.
You've made every kind of movie.
I've made every kind of movie.
You've made every kind of movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You've done movies with Steven Spielberg and dinosaurs.
That's right.
You've done sequels where Anthony Hopkins chops his own hand off because he's so in love with you.
Right. I've done independent dramas.
P.T. Anderson movies.
P.T. Anderson, yeah. Scary movies.
Black and white movies.
Bad. Have I done any black and white?
Did you do a black and white movie?
I don't know that I have.
They didn't remake Psycho in black and white. They did it in color.
They did it in color, yeah.
Okay.
That was a remake. That was a shot-by-shot remake.
No, that I know.
You know, so it...
Which in an interview I read, you thought that was something you should not have done.
I think it failed. I don't think that I shouldn't have done it, but I do think that the...
When you're doing the film that is a shot-by-shot... I mean, I just find this fascinating psychologically. When you do a film... I mean, I'm not just saying this for your benefit. You are a very, 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 very talented woman.
Aww.
And Van Zandt is a good director.
He's a very good director, yeah.
What does Van Zandt... When he's remaking shot-by-shot one of the greatest thrillers in history...
Right.
Did Van Zandt have to say anything to bolster you to get through that experience? Was he like trying to?
No, and it wasn't like we had to be bolstered to get through it. I think we were all very specifically trying to recreate it. But and now I wish if we were to do it again, I would like to do it in black and white. I'd like to do it in the same costume. I'd like to do it with the exact same intonation.
Let's do the better remake of Psycho.
Like
Shop
that.
For
that
Shop.
To me, I think that would have been instead we sort of modernized it, but then kept the old pacing.
Anne Heche.
It was great.
Who was Norman?
Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn. How was Van Zandt as a director?
He was great. He's such a lovely person. Very, very soft-spoken. You know, just incredibly, incredibly soft-spoken. I liked him a lot. I'd like to work with him on something that
I love Elephant. Elephant. I always tell people, see Elephant, which is his Columbine film. Oh, my God. What an amazing film. It's an amazing film. It's like the most hypnotic film that has a Columbine type of theme to it. And I love Gus. I think Gus is incredible.
I think my favorite kind of acting to do, though, I saw Todd Haynes, my friend Todd Haynes, who I made Far From Heaven and Safe with, and we had dinner together and we were talking about our experience. And he said, how did you understand how minimal the acting was going to be? And I said, I felt like I saw it in the language. His language was so spare and so specific. And then I would say, let me see the frame. And his frames were also, I felt like he was communicating so much just in the frame. So my favorite thing as an actor is to know what the director's vision is, to have communicated that way through the language and in the shot. And then I'm like, now I know what I'm doing.
Give me an example.
Well, like when Todd had a shot of a very wide living room, you know, at a baby shower, and there were a bunch of women all the way at the right side of the frame. I had crossed all the way across and was standing up on the left side of frame, and I just asked where the ladies' room, and my only line is, "Can you tell me where the ladies' room is, please?" or something like that. And I could see it was all about this movement of her kind of trying to reach over these people. So once I looked at that, I was like, okay, well, I can see if I hunch my shoulders forward, then this little figure is kind of bowed in this big, wide frame, you know? So he's telling the story of alienation. You know, you don't have to talk about anything. You just do it. It's great.
When I was saying before how I think, you know, I know what it is people hire you for, what they expect from you, I think the ingredient in the meal that you are is a tremendous amount of emotional truth.
Huh.
You have a kind of emotional resonance, which you turn on and off.
Yeah.
You know, like I want to talk to you about P.T. Anderson for a minute. Well, like when you do Boogie Nights and that character you played someone who was so cut off to that, then that's what I perceived.
From her reality.
What
yeah.
I perceived yeah. was did you make a choice with this woman,
yeah.
with that famous scene you have with him, where he's going to have sex with you when you tell him, you can do this to me, and you're very mad, do this, you can do this to me, go ahead. And you're kind of holding it. It's like his first day at school.
Well, she's in complete denial about what's going on. She's someone who's made an economic choice. You know, really, she's given up her family, she's given up her child. She probably was in a position where this was the only kind of work she could get. She's a drug addict.
Did you meet any of those people?
Yeah.
You did.
She's a drug addict. My favorite scene in the movie is when she goes to court to get custody of her son.
We're talking about Boogie Nights,
yeah,
by
Boogie
the way,
Nights.
For people who are listening.
And she's all dressed up, and she's trying to be kind of a straight arrow and stuff, and she feels very self-righteous about getting her child back. And the judge looks at her and says, "Maggie, have you ever been arrested?" And that's the end. And you go, oh, my God. This, you know, she's of course she's been arrested, you know, and she just sobs and sobs and sobs. And you go, so this is a woman who in her head thinks that she can be a parent, but she can't.
Yeah.
She's not living a life that's going to allow herself to parent a child, but she won't. There's a huge space between what she feels about herself and what was actually happening.
That's the first time you worked with Anderson?
Yeah.
And what had you been doing before that? What did he see you in? What did he cast you off of?
Safe. I don't know. I think he saw me in I think he saw me Shortcuts and Safe and Vanya and all that stuff. You know, Paul was very young. He was 26 when we met. We met at a party, and a friend of mine introduced me to him and said, "This guy wrote this script and he wants you to do it." And I was like, "I would love to read it." And he said, "You're going to be in my movie, man." Got the script and I read it, and I was like, "Holy cow! Yes, I am. This is fantastic." He has such an original voice. It was so exciting. It was such an amazing story and so emotional and wonderful and rich. And yeah, I was lucky to get it. You know what you were saying? I was thinking about how you talk about emotion, you know, on camera and stuff. You have that too. You have this tremendous vitality, like a real sense of being alive and a lot contained inside you. And it's wonderful to work with you because it just permeates the scene. Like, you know, you feel that. That's the trick. The trick is, how do you live on camera? How do you become alive on camera? So there's all this stuff about acting. You know, you can kind of create a character and do all this kind of stuff. You know.
Set your pride aside. You don't have to worry about how you look.
Yeah, but be alive. Yeah. Be alive. You did that great thing when we had that scene in Still Alice. You know, we had to say, "Remember Santorini," which is always really hard to start a scene with. That kind of a thing, and you said, and then you started laughing so hard, and then I started laughing, and then suddenly it's a scene about two people laughing because
I was trying to remember Santorini.
You're like, what? But you know, it's like that's what you want. You know, that's why I like to talk when I work.
What do people expect from you or think of you when they meet you?
I think they think that I'm going to be more serious than I am. I guess because of all the dramas and the crying and stuff,
right.
They think that I'm going to be really dramatic and sad.
Because of the emotion of the films
you
do. Yeah,
but I'm not, as you know, I'm not a very serious person.
Right.
And I'm not a terribly sad person.
But you are when you,
know?
You need to be.
Sure.
But you say.
Yeah, I can be serious, but
you don't
but
have
I
to
mean,
live there all the
I
time.
Like to, I'm very chatty. I like to talk all the way up to action. I do. And if you can't talk to me, I'm really disappointed. Then I get lonely. I don't want to be lonely when I'm working.
Yeah.
I want to be with my buddy.
Talk to me.
Let's be buddies. Talk to me. What'd you do this morning? What'd you have for dinner last night? What are you doing later today? Are you cold? Do you like that sweater? Do you like my sweater? What are you doing? Action. Acting. I love it. That's my favorite part.
Yeah.
Then you get this great connection with another human being. And then the scene is like, poof, comes alive.
But
you know?
Why do you think that emotion is so available to you? Why?
It's inside. It's inside everybody. Everyone. So it's like, how do you access that? you know, your own story, everybody else's story. You know, what you're getting on top is just like the tiniest little like shell. Other than that, there's all this stuff. But then, like I said, it's easier for me to get into it when I'm talking to you about, you know, how much I like your sweater and, you know, where you live and are you going to rent or are you going to buy or, all that kind of stuff. You know, how are your kids? How was seventh grade for so-and-so? I mean, I love all that stuff.
I remember when I was younger, I think it was even unconscious as I would see people act in films.
Mm-hmm.
And the predominant examples would be like Brando or Pacino or something like that, where them breaking down wasn't a big deal. These were like notes you played in music.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's just what people do. I didn't think about it like it was separate because I went to Strasbourg where they really,
right.
They put you in the frying pan and they really made you get to that.
Yeah.
And I went to acting school for a year where we basically cried for like a year.
They try to get you used to being able to...
To tap into that.
But the funny thing is that that's just a technique to get you to tap into it because people don't really behave that way. But you have to find it. Once again, it's all about what's true, what's real. It's like guns in movies and guns going off and people hitting people. Sometimes, especially early on in my career, people would be like, and then someone gets slapped. And I thought, wait, people don't slap each other. And if somebody does, it's shocking. So remember that when there's a physical altercation, you're shocked by it. When people cry, it's upsetting. You're not trying to cry. You're trying not to cry because you don't want to be embarrassed. You know, so it's like, so all that acting school stuff is about learning how to locate all those feelings. But then over time and with experience, you learn like the greats, like Brando, to modulate them.
When you worked with P.T., mm-hmm. with Paul Thomas Anderson, Boogie Nights was the first film. Was he helpful to you as a director, or did it all basically take care of itself because it was so well-written?
It took care of itself. I have to say all
he stands back and you just go.
The great directors, all the greatest directors say very, very little. Magnolia was harder because it was so emotional, and I was really trying to plot it, you know, because I had to literally cry in every scene, and so I had to, I'm like, all right, Paul, this is like the smaller crying into the bigger crying, the biggest crying into the big, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like I had to find a way to
the
not
symphony.
Be, it wasn't like the level of hysteria had to change, you know, I had to be modulated. I couldn't be at 10, I had to be at 2 and, you know, get to 10 and all that kind of stuff. There are times when I'll say to a director, I want you to watch my vocal pattern. I want you to watch my level of hysteria. I want you to whatever. But basically, I want them to direct the movie. Do you know? I feel like it's a misnomer that a director is an acting coach. The director is there to direct the audience's eye through a film. The actor is doing the acting. They shouldn't have to say, you know, I think
when
you
had a tough time with the director, how was it tough? Without naming names, what was tough?
When they talked to me too much.
They did.
Well, because I always say to everybody, please don't speak to me before I've done any acting. I said, because I'm just trying
let's
to hang
what
on
I come
to
up
this.
With.
Yeah, let's see what I come up with. And if I'm way off base, then please, by all means, come up and say like, wow, that wasn't what I expected. But if I hear too much, I mean, this is going to sound really silly and precious, but I always say that acting, so it's like this little flame. And you've got this like little thing and you're thinking, okay, I want this to work, but you don't want to blow it out. And if somebody comes along and says, this is what I think, they might just blow it out and then you have nowhere, you know, then you can't reach it anymore.
Now, as emotional as you are on, and you have this remarkable emotional resonance in your work, what do you like privately to the extent that you want to say you're a mother?
Yes.
You were married before.
I'm married now. With my husband for 18 years. We have two children.
They're
16 and 12.
Right.
I have a fantastic, fantastic family. I have two dogs. They're black. One is small and one is big, a Chihuahua and a lab. And we live in New York City. I have a really nice life. I'm really, really lucky.
You try to keep it simple?
Oh, man, yeah, I really do. I try to keep it as simple
as possible.
How do
you and he tag team work-wise? Because he makes films.
He makes films and television, too. You know, we've been very fortunate. I mean, it's interesting because the work-life balance thing is always an issue for everybody. When they're little, when they were babies, it was super, super easy because babies don't know where they are and you can bring them everywhere.
Just feed them and they're good.
Yeah, and also we have an incredibly tolerant business toward women with children. I have to say, thank goodness for the movie business. I remember my son was, when I was doing Psycho, as a matter of fact, my son was 9 months old and I was still getting used to having a baby and he was always with me and stuff. And he was hysterical in the trailer one day and I was nursing him and trying to get him to calm down. And they knocked on the trailer door and they said, you know, we need you. And I was like, they said, my baby's crying. I can't come.
Yeah.
And And this adorable PA said, "No worries, man. Take your time."
Yeah.
And I was like, holy cow, I'm the luckiest woman in the world. You know, I mean, so our business is very tolerant. We're lucky. And I have no complaints as an actress.
Did you turn down a lot of work because of your family?
You do. You turn things down because you can't travel. You know, you're like, once the kids are in school, I can't go.
I'm leaving to do a film in a few days and I feel terrible.
Right.
I do. I feel horrible.
Yeah. It's tough. And it's tougher on women because when you have infants, you know, I mean, it's easier for you because you can go and come back. But it doesn't make it mean it's emotionally easy for you. But yeah, so I work. I try to work. If I have to travel, I do it in the summertime when everybody can come. I work in the city when they're in school and I, you know, try to, or I bunch things. If I have to travel, I bunch it together and, you know, and I have a partner who's an equal parent and we alternate stuff.
Michael Fox said that to me once years ago. He said, they send you a script and the script said, "Open on the skyline of Manhattan." He'd close the script and say, "I'm in."
That's it. Absolutely.
I mean, I'm done. Just write me a check.
You have no idea. This tax break in New York City has been a godsend to me.
We got
to
keep that going.
It's amazing because I've been able to do so many movies at home. I mean, it really. And then, yeah, I'm like, shoot's in New York. All right, fine. It's great.
To hear Alec's complete conversation with Julianne Moore, go to heresthething.org. Maggie Gyllenhaal has embraced a wide range of work in her career, from big-budget films like The Dark Knight and Nanny McPhee to off-Broadway theater. She was nominated for an Academy Award for her work in Crazy Heart, and she won a Golden Globe for her performance on the TV series The Honorable Woman. Alec talked with Maggie Gyllenhaal before a live audience at the Hamptons International Film Festival in 2018. Maggie Gyllenhaal majored in English literature at Columbia, and Alec wondered whether she started performing in plays there as well.
I did a lot. First, I mean, I had one teacher there who I learned a lot from, this woman, Joan Rosenfels. But I don't know, I guess I was a Columbian. I sort of felt like I'm a Columbia, like I should study what Columbia does best.
Well, not acting, yeah.
Yeah.
I tell people that now who are students who go to degree-granting universities for drama. And I say, don't just take drama and acting. Take something where you're going to read a lot of books, philosophy, literature, history. But you're there getting. And what's the first production you do in New York? Do you remember?
Like my first.
When you got to Columbia, you did plays. What'd you do?
What did I do at Columbia? What was the first one? Oh, I did a student production of No Exit with this guy who became my boyfriend named Dante. Who was actually 25 and had already graduated from college.
So, but he was in a student production, Dante.
Yeah, he was sweet.
He'd be in prison now if that happened, correct? Exactly.
So I did that. I also did The Tempest, and I played Prospera.
With Dante in that too?
No. He didn't make it in that one. but yeah, that was the first one, was No Exit.
When you graduated with a degree in literature, was acting the goal? Is that what you wanted to do?
Yeah, I did. I always wanted to be an actress. Uh-huh. And I feel like, okay, in college you can read, although there's so much you're supposed to read. I feel like I never had read all of it. Uh-huh. But I feel like I really learned to write in college. And I don't know about you, but I feel like there's been so many times where I've had, you know, lines I wanted changed or a cut that I wanted shifted or something I had to sort out on a set that I had to write an email or even have a conversation where I had to organize my thoughts before I had it, where I think, thank God I went to college because I was able to say what I meant to say, you know?
Well, it helps if you have that background because did you feel there was a progression for you? In the beginning, you were timid and shy, you know, less assertive. And I want to find out, when did that begin to change? Was there a moment you sat there and you said, I need to defend my position and I think I know what's best for me?
I think, you know, I don't know that it was, I think basically it was progressive, right? Like basically you're right. I was younger and newer and it was harder for me to say what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten easier as I've had more experience. Mm-hmm. But I also think that different sets give way to a different way of working. So first I'm a jobbing actress and I'm trying to get jobs and I come in for 2 days or one afternoon or whatever. And you're like, oh, you want me to do it like that? I don't know. That doesn't sound really very good to me, but I'm afraid to say, let's say. Yeah. Or maybe I do try to say and I get shut down and I accept it and whatever. That's like, you know, it's very hard to do when you're coming in for 1 second. It's like going to a new school where everybody knows each other and you're there for an afternoon. But then, like, when I worked on Secretary, which was really early on, I mean, I was 22, I had a real point of view about what I wanted to say, and Steve Shainberg, who directed it, was really interested in that. Yeah. And I also think he knew that things were happening that I didn't have any idea were happening.
Wasn't all on the page.
And also my 22, I think I'm being very intellectual and I've come from college and I studied feminist theory and everything, you know, and I think I'm saying this. And I think, even if he's 20 years older than me, that he was able to see, I know she thinks she's saying this, but this whole other thing is also happening. And he put all that in the film. But so that was a space where I felt I was totally able to.
Collaborative.
Yes. Yeah. And then I went to work on a movie after that, which I won't name, where I was totally shut down. And I was shocked by it.
I always remember, like, you go to a movie, and this is just, you know, my opinion, but like you do a film, and you want to be told what to do, basically. My whole thing is, you're making the movie. What movie are you making? How do I fit in? Mm. I do one of the first movies I did. I was lucky. I did this movie Working Girl with Mike Nichols, and Nichols says, "You're gonna have sex." Yeah, he goes, "You're gonna have sex with this woman, and she catches you having sex. How would you have sex? They're being caught." And I go, "Well," and I try to think of like what's the most comical, you know, thing. And he goes, and he was very gracious. He's like, "That's not a bad idea. That's not a bad idea." But what I think really sells it, if she's just completely naked and you're completely naked and she's just sitting right on top of you, just riding you. And me and the actor were like, oh. We had a much more chaste and kind of like silly version of that. And me and the girl were like, and he was like, okay, come now, close off, let's go. But the idea of that clarity, time saving, somebody who comes in and says this.
Yeah, but the
you
thing
prefer
is,
that?
Well, I always use my fantasy movie I would have made with Mike Nichols as like the example of, if Mike Nichols is directing this, yes, I want to be told exactly what to do, please. Like I watch his movies and I'm like, he's directing everybody. He's like pushing everybody further and deeper and funnier and wilder than they ever would go. In fact, the one time I worked with Mike Nichols was on this reading. It's not a movie or even a play that was ever produced. It was just a few day long reading of a play that Alan Alda wrote. Bob Balaban directed the reading, but Mike was sort of producing it, I guess. He came up to me after a day of rehearsal and he just said, "She's feral, the character." And I've often thought that was the best direction I've ever gotten, because it doesn't say, like, you know, I don't know, directors ever come up to you and say, like, "I'm worried that we're not going to be able to tell that you're mad because you're acting so nice, and I'm worried that it's not going to communicate, you know, or I'm afraid that you're going too far in this direction, or I'm afraid that you're, you know, going to confuse people by something that you're doing." I have been told that before. But Mike Nichols is basically going, like, go further, like in any direction you could possibly go. Like what he said to you, you know, go all the way. She's feral. I was playing Marie Curie, and he's saying, like, she's a wild animal.
She's a wild cat.
Because the other part's taken care of. She's Marie Curie, you know.
All the French radiologists knew that back then. She was wild, that Marie Curie.
But so I want to be told what to do. Yes, I wish for that kind of collaboration, but I don't go in expecting that it's going to happen. I want it.
Who is a director you worked with? Because I think you and I maybe share this from what you said, where we're not out to offend anyone, but, you know, think of somebody who it was really just great, you loved working with. other than your current collaboration. We're going to get to that, but
which
another
one. Which I did love, yes. My current collaboration. I have a few that I've really loved.
Martin Scorsese on Vanya?
Right. That Martin Scorsese directed, supposedly, according to Wikipedia, me and my husband
I'm
in researching, a 200-seat
Wikipedia,
theater
it says
in New York.
She did an Uncle Vanya at
CSC.
At CSC.
It's like a tiny black box theater in New York.
And it says Martin Scorsese directed the checkup. And I go, my God, this is like the seismic thing that got by me. It's like someone walking up to you going, you know the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, right?
It's totally
like,
wrong.
No, I didn't know that.
And then in this Wikipedia entry that Alec just showed me, it then goes on to quote a terrible review of me in the play.
That's not a good section of that Wikipedia.
I gotta get
so Scorsese
that.
Did not direct
no,
Vanya.
No, but Austin Pendleton did, and he is one of the most incredible directors I've ever worked with
tell
in my
why.
Life. Austin. It's funny. Austin asked me to do Uncle Vanya, and he, when they offered it to me, they sent me this interview with Austin, and it basically talks about this sort of incredible way that he likes to work with actors, you know, where everyone's free to respond to each other in the moment on stage, you know, all the fantasies that actors have of a way that you could actually really work together, which rarely happens. And I was like, Austin, I'd love to do this. I'd love to work this way, you know, where it's all just reacting to the reality of the moment with the other person on stage. And how everybody says that's what they want to do. How are you actually going to do it? And he's like, well, you got to come and work with me to find out. And the truth is I don't know how he created this situation where everybody on stage had deep respect for each other, even though it was clear to me that there were actors who were stronger than others, that there were, but it made no difference. You know, I know one way he did it. I remember the first day of rehearsal, he said, however you imagined Sonia, whatever fantasy you had of who Sonia was gonna be when you read this play, Sonia is her. Sonia's this person. And all the feelings you have about this person, about the way that ricochets off what you anticipated when you read the play, that's all useful, but Sonia is her. And so we did create this little black box theater situation where, and I did it with my husband, and he's a brilliant actor, so that was cool. And we got to pretend we were having an affair. Both Chekhovs we did, we were playing people who were having affairs, which was really hot and great, you know? but I loved working with Austin. I also loved, I loved Hugo Blick, who directed The Honorable Woman.
You got a Golden Globe for that.
Yeah.
You mentioned me. That was one of the longest times you were overseas and away from home.
Yeah, and
shooting.
And it's funny. I really admire what you said about how, for you, your trust is a director's to lose. I wish I could be like that, but I'm not. And I go in with my guard up. And secretly, I want the deepest, most intense artistic collaboration possible, but it's not easy for me. And with Hugo, I think we were both like that. And, you know, it was 8 hours of television. I'd only ever done a 2-hour movie before. I didn't know how to do that. And I'm in every minute of every scene, and it's super intense.
A lot of work with somebody to be
covered
with somebody.
And it could have been terrible, you know? But I remember about 2/3 of the way through, I came over to him, and I just sort of said something in his ear about the scene. Oh, I think we need to shift this, and actually, can we move this here, and could this happen over here? Almost shorthand at this point. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. And someone sitting next to him said, do you just do whatever she says? And he said, he's English also, he said, I trust her completely, like that. And I took it in like, whoa, actually he was kidding, but I kind of think he does. And then at the very end, on the very, very last day, I had this voiceover to record, which plays at the beginning of every episode. And it's basically about trust. And it basically, I think it says something like, you have to just, I mean, not in these words, but what it meant was you either trust nobody or you just jump off the cliff and you trust. And I was like, he put me in this little room to record it because we'd forgotten to record it. And I was like, Hugo, do you mind if I say it to you? And so he came in the room with me. And I basically, the subtext, I guess, of what I was saying to him was, I trust you, you know?
Maggie Gyllenhaal. If you're enjoying this conversation, be sure to follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Maggie Gyllenhaal talks about working with the children in the movie, The Kindergarten Teacher. I'm Carrie Donahue, and this is Here's the Thing. In the 2018 film, The Kindergarten Teacher, Maggie Gyllenhaal plays a dissatisfied 40-something teacher from Staten Island who becomes fixated on the talent of one of her students. She heard about the project at a holiday party.
Two people at the party said, have you heard about this script, The Kindergarten Teacher? It's coming to you. And it's great. And for me, I think it's really, really rare to read a great script. And also to have two people in one night out of nowhere just say, like, there's this great script and it's coming to you. I was like, okay. I was waiting every day after that for the script to come. And it took a while. And when it came, I read it. And I won't give anything away. The ending is pretty great. And I closed the last page of the script and I was like, I want this movie. You know, and it wasn't clear to me that it was offered to me, which actually just increased my appetite for it more, of course. They say now it always was, but I didn't know that. And one of the producer's mothers was having an operation in the hospital, and like nobody got back to me for a few days after I like really energetically raised my hand and was like, yes, please, what do I gotta do? And again, just waiting just made me want it more. And then they came back and they were like, oh, yes, we always meant to.
And it's based on another film.
Yeah, it's based on an Israeli movie, which I haven't seen.
Deliberately.
Yeah. I mean, I probably should see it now. I've heard wonderful things about it. And I've heard that narratively, it's very similar. And yet, it tells an almost entirely different story. So our movie, I think, is really about the consequences of what happens when you starve a vibrant woman's mind, told from the point of view of a group of women filmmakers. And our conclusion is that it's fucking dire, you know? And I think the Israeli movie, which has a very similar narrative, is much more about masculinity in Israel and art in a country at war and very different things, even though the story itself is very similar. So I got the script and then I signed up. And then, you know, it was not easy to get our money. In fact, at Sundance, when we first premiered, I shook the hands of 50 executive producers who had, you know, all together somehow helped us cobble together the money to make it. So we spent a while doing that. And then we made it in 23 days in New York.
In New York.
Yeah.
Now, when you work with, this sounds like a silly thing, but I always think about this in terms of the brevity of schedules now and the pressure to shoot efficiently now, but with children, I find is very specific. And in the movie, in, for my money, the young boy, what's his name?
Jimmy in the movie, the character, Parker.
Parker, mm-hmm. The boy we had the funniest moment yesterday because I said this kid's fantastic after the movie, and somebody from the festival said, "Well, he loves Boss Baby." He's like, "How old is he? Like 5?"
He's 6.
So we go backstage and I'm like, this is amazing. You're doing like this really hypnotic, creepy drama, which is great. And I'm in Boss Baby. I mean, you and I, we have so much in common, you and I. You know, we're both in the business. Different wings of the business, maybe. Parker. But we had a lot of fun with him. But when you're working with somebody, like a lot of times, kids are performing and the kids that climb the ladder a little bit in that division, they're very, you know, they're ready to come, you know, sing Tomorrow on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And he's not.
No.
He's very real.
Yeah.
And was that a decision you and she talked about, you and Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I felt a couple of things very strongly. I have a child who's 6 and who was 5 when we made it, just like Parker's 5. So it's hard to remember what it's like to be 5. I mean, how different the world is, unless you're 5. You have a 5-year-old, I know, right?
Yeah.
Or unless you're living with a 5-year-old. And then you're in that mind, kind of. So I felt 2 things. I felt I almost didn't do the movie at one point because I thought, no movie, no matter how much I love it or think it's important or whatever, is worth disturbing a child, even for a few minutes. So I was like, how are we going to do this? And I also don't think 5-6-year-olds are actors. I just don't believe that. And I don't think it's fair to ask them to be actors. So I felt like, so basically we worked in a couple ways. I learned this from Emma Thompson, actually, who I'm in love with, and who did Nanny McPhee. We did Nanny McPhee together, and we had tons of kids. And so often, especially with the very littlest one, we would just be like, stand on the X. Now look at that big black X on the wall and turn your head when I say so. When I clap, turn your head and say, I don't want to go. And we would clap, he'd turn his head, he'd say, I don't want to go. And I would say, no, sing it like me. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. No. And then he would just sort of repeat. I would be like, you have to just sing it. Like
Parker.
To Parker. Sing it. And so then he'd kind of just imitate my inflections. That was one way we worked with him, so that it was just a song. It wasn't like he actually, you can't say to a 5-year-old, I want you to get in touch with the way in which you, I mean, like, but the other thing you can do with 5-year-olds is that they will forget that the camera's on them, sort of. So we ran all the kindergarten stuff as if it were a kindergarten. I mean, you see them singing those songs with me or painting, or you're not gonna say, okay, we're gonna pretend to paint, or we're gonna like pretend to write X's on a piece of paper. We're just gonna do it. And we choreographed the camera. I would sort of see where the camera was going, almost like a documentary. And then I would just like scoot over to wherever the camera was and begin the scene with whoever I needed to be talking to in that scene. And then the other funny thing about kids and the like short schedule is there were quite a few times where I did scenes with our first AD or our gaffer who would read off camera for me because the little boy had to go. And I'd be like, this is really weird. But, you know, like the way you can trip yourself out as an actor, kind of, and you can be like, oh, there's helicopters going over all the time. We have to keep stopping in the middle. I'm really frustrated. And then all of a sudden, the frustration just goes back into the scene. So this one, I was like, oh, this is like a hairy 50-year-old guy with like a scrubby, you know, beard.
Easy now.
No. Our first AD. And he's lying on the ground, slating also. And I'd be like, oh, but I'm, okay, so I'm basically talking to this child as if he's a man. You know, you just figure out the way to throw it back in. Because what else are you going to do?
Well, I'd love it if on my next film, you would come and do that X acting with me. Would you be there for me? You'd be my Mira Rostova, you know, like off the set going, turn to me. And say, I don't want to go to prison. I don't want to go to prison for tax evasion. You know, we could do that. You'd be my acting coach. That's amazing. An ex-acting thing. I need to work with you, man. I'm dying to get a script with you.
It was Emma Thompson, really.
Emma Thompson.
You can imagine.
The 3 of us.
She's pretty damn good at that, too.
Now, what about Sarah? How many films had she made before she made this film?
I loved working with Sarah.
Yeah.
And it was a totally different kind of experience than I had ever had before. And in some ways, I like to think it was a very feminine set, right? Sarah wrote and directed it. Our financiers were women. Our producers were women. It's all about a woman. But I'd worked with a lot of other women and had very different kinds
You've
of experience.
You've worked with a few women directors.
I have.
Right?
I've worked with many. I mean, even on The Deuce last season, 7 out of 8 directors were women. You know,
is there a difference?
Well, there is a difference. Yeah, there is. But that's not necessarily what made, I think, my collaboration with Sarah and our set on The Kindergarten Teacher so, I don't know, unusual, yeah, feminine, but I don't even totally know what that means. Even when I watch the movie, I'm like, this is feminine. Like, what does that mean and why? And my husband, after he saw it last night, he was like, I wish someone would send this to Senator Flake. But I don't really know totally why, right? It's not a political movie, but it's like somehow it's really kind of straight, purely feminine thing. It makes me think of The Piano, not this movie. I would never compare it to that, but the experience I had when I saw The Piano and I was like 16 or something and I had never seen anything like it. I was like, what? Like, I guess I think in some ways, girls, women my age, we get so used to having to relate to a male character, or even, let's just say, like a sort of masculine point of view on something. We're like, yeah, that's not exactly my experience, but I could twist it around and make it relatable to me. And that muscle is very exercised, I think, in most women. We're like, I know it's not exactly my way through the world, but I could just twist a little, and it's cool, I get it. And thank God, because otherwise we'd have very little to relate to. But then, like, when I saw The Piano, I was like, whoa, I feel so relaxed. I don't have to twist anything. And I felt that way when I read Sarah's script. I just, like, went straight in. And
When I saw this last night, what I love is that it's not a bad, I don't want to give it away, but the dynamic of the home is not all bad.
No.
But there's things that maybe, in my mind, you know, are missing. There's things you want that are gone.
Yeah.
And connections and feelings that are gone.
No, exactly. It's a much easier movie if her home life is like horrible.
Really, the husband.
If everything's just awful. Instead, she's
I'm not going to give away the scene on the phone.
Yeah.
And your husband's like, he's ready to, you know, do a little dance with you. And then the phone rings.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Really upsetting scene.
Yeah.
Like, so fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
There's a couple of really fucked up scenes in this movie. It's incredible.
It's true.
So you're doing The Deuce. You're on HBO. Mm. How did that happen? Meaning, how did they reel you in? I mean, I'm not just saying this for your benefit. You were one of the most admired movie actresses in the business. So when you go to do the TV thing, how did they hook you?
Well, it's so funny though, because like in the first three episodes, which was all I read of The Deuce, Candy didn't really have all that much to do, you know?
That's why you took the job.
No, but it's weird because I was just talking with Peter about this when we were walking on the beach here today. I was like, she turns so amazing. I mean, I love playing Candy, I really do. But I just had like a feeling. I don't know. It was David Simon and George Pelicanos. I mean, they've made some pretty damn good TV. And I had done The Honorable Woman with Hugo, who I told you I loved so much. So it wasn't my first time in TV. I wasn't like snobby about TV. I wanted it. You know, I wanted a good job, you know, that I could count on. But also
stay home.
Yes, and nice to be thing. Home. But also I was like, I don't know, I just had a good feeling. I was like, I just want to play this woman. I want to try it. I want to see if I can do this. It was so far outside of my experience to play a sex worker in 1971. I just like liked her. I just had like this feeling about it.
You signed for three seasons.
Three seasons.
Not a long contract.
No. Yeah,
that's cool.
And I guess you know, there was this whole thing where I was like, guys, I've only read three. There's going to be 24. How do I know? I mean, I think you guys are all right, but what if this becomes something? I mean, I never had signed on
trust.
To something like that before. Well, that's true.
The T word.
But again, like I said, I don't trust that well. So I asked them if I could be a producer. And the thing is when, and everyone said to me, you are never going to get that. On a big HBO show, you've never produced television before, you didn't develop it, like, good luck, Maggie. But then they were like, okay,
great.
Let's be partners.
Good for you.
And I was like, oh, wow.
Good for you, you know? Good for you. My last question is a quick two-parter. Now, I had a very fleeting role in Looming Tower with your husband, Peter Sarsgaard, and my first question, which is a silly question, is your husband really as sweet as he seems?
Yeah,
he's one of the loveliest men I've ever met in my life.
He's a damn good husband.
He's a sweet guy.
I'm thrilled with him.
And what's that like for you, being two people who are working all the time, very successful movie actors? Is it wonderful to be with somebody who understands what you're going through? I'm married to a woman that's not in the business. And sometimes it's
like sometimes I'll be like, when are you coming home? I don't understand. When are you coming home? Like, we had planned such and such. And he's like, Maggie, you know I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. My wife was like, my wife sometimes is like, Alec, why are you so dramatic? And I'm like, duh. Anyway, Maggie Gyllenhaal, everybody.
Thanks to actors Julianne Moore and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and of course to Alec Baldwin, who, you know, normally hosts this show. Here's the Thing is produced by Kathleen Russo, me, Carrie Donahue, and Zach McNeese. Our engineer is Frank Imperial.
Carrie, am I coming back next week?
Yes, Alec. You're back next week, and you're talking to Jackson Brown. But every other week for the rest of the summer, members of our team will be popping into the feed to showcase terrific interviews from the archives.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks, Alec.